We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is our technical director. In high school, she dreamed of being president of the United States. It was a wildly ambitious dream. In 1952, she was the only woman in her class to graduate from Northwestern University Law School. She was first in her class. Dawn Clark Netsch has spent her life in politics, serving in the Illinois legislature as comptroller and making a run for governor. The Democrat has made a mark on Chicago and Illinois politics. Now in her 80s, she remains an advocate for political reform, and she's currently a professor of law emerita at Northwestern. Our guest this morning is Dawn Clark Netsch's biographer, Cynthia Grant Bowman. Bowman's biography, Dawn Clark Netsch, A Political Life, is the latest in the Northwestern Chicago Lives series. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this morning. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Cynthia Grant Bowman joined the faculty of the Cornell Law School in 2007. Before moving to Cornell, she was a professor of law and gender studies at Northwestern. She has written extensively about the law and women. Dawn Clark Netsch, A Political Life, is published by Northwestern University Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and the email willtalk@illinois.edu. Professor Bowman, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
I'm delighted to be here with you.
So let's talk about Dawn Clark Netsch. I found this amazing. Before she graduated from high school, Patricia Dawn Clark, she was saying she wanted to be in politics or in the diplomatic service. She said, I want to be president. You have to recall that she was born just 6 years after the 19th Amendment was ratified. Did she have any sense as a young woman of what an uphill course it would be?
Well, I think she always knew that it would be not easy, but she seems to have, from a very young age, not been intimidated by people or struggles, and just assumed that it was something that she could do if she wanted to do it.
What was she like as a child?
Well, my only knowledge of that was I interviewed her brother, and she obviously was more studious than he, and he thought that she was a little goody-goody. That is, he got punished by the parents for doing things, and she never seemed to. I talked to someone who went to high school with her, and he said that she was a lot of fun, that she was she had a kind of sharp wit and was a good deal of fun to be with.
And that served her well. That has served her well throughout the course of her life.
It has. In fact, it's still a good description of her today.
Yeah, yeah. Her parents, she was born in Cincinnati in the fall of 1926, and her parents were Charterites. Who were the Charterites?
Well, I want to correct you. I'm not sure her parents were Charterites. I think her parents were actually Republicans.
Okay.
But Dawn's first political activity was for this group, the Charterites.
Okay.
Who... there was not a Democratic Party in Cincinnati at that time, and they were a group seeking to reform city government and ultimately to have a new charter that would set up a city manager form of government for Cincinnati, which had previously had an old-style political boss.
That provides us with some foreshadowing, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. How did that shape her, do you suppose, that experience?
Well, I guess she got, an idea of what it's like to go door to door, which she's done plenty of in her life. And I think she also found Cincinnati too small a stage, that she wanted a place which had a strong Democratic Party. And when she came to Chicago, she found it.
Yeah. She began to find her voice on the high school newspaper. That was interesting. And she also helped with the war effort. This is a very, very active and involved young person.
Indeed, she was. She seems to have played a role in almost all of the clubs there at Withrow High School in Cincinnati. I looked at a copy of her high school yearbook, and there's a picture of her in almost every activity.
How did she decide on Northwestern for her undergraduate work and then later for law school?
You know, I think it was, to some extent, serendipity that she knew a friend who was going to go there. And she didn't know much about it, but she knew she wanted to get away from home, including universities that were too close to home. And she considered maybe she should go to Harvard or Radcliffe, and then decided, no, she needed a coeducational setting because if she was going into politics, she had to be able to deal with men and not just be in an all-female setting. Hmm. So she followed a friend of hers to Northwestern.
Tell us about her life in the mid-40s at Northwestern as an undergrad.
Well, it was an interesting time. When she arrived, it was still wartime, and the campus was kind of given over to wartime activity and not a place. There were very few young men, obviously, in college. They were all drafted. And during her period there, they returned, so that a lot of veterans accompanied her both through undergraduate school and law school. And they tended to be more mature, more decisive about what they wanted to do, and perhaps more politically active. Evanston at that time was a rather conservative place. And the dormitories and many places in the city were segregated. And to Dawn, that was anathema. She, from a very early age, knew that she identified with racial minorities and felt that they needed to be treated equally. Almost instinctively, she felt that from a very young girl on. And so she got involved in a campaign through the Northwestern Daily, which is the college newspaper, to try to integrate the dorms. And if you were African American and wanted to go to Northwestern at that time, you had a difficult time finding a place to live. There was a YMCA on Emerson, which would take African American men. But African American women literally would have a very difficult time finding a place to stay. And so the Daily Northwestern, she and her co-editors, launched a big campaign. And ultimately, it was successful in getting the administration to open a place called an international house. That is, a separate dormitory where African Americans could live and white students could live there too, but not many did, ended up living there. So it was a sort of mixed victory because, in a sense, it was a bit segregated in itself.
International house?
Yes, an international house in order for African Americans to live there.
Yeah,
right?
Very peculiar. Did she become involved later in the civil rights movement?
Well, she did. I mean, her career intersects with the civil rights movement in so many ways throughout her life. I mean, certainly as a legislator, the kinds of things that she pushed. She's been very involved in housing, the open housing movement, and Civil Liberties Union in a whole variety of ways. She's always been very involved. Did she go south and march? No. That wasn't the generation to which she belonged.
Mm. What was her sense of the women's movement in the late 60s and 70s?
Well, now that's an intriguing question because now that's a period that I know from my own youth, and Dawn is a generation before me. And it's not something that she identified with. She, in fact, kind of distanced herself, that she wasn't a women's liber, and that she was, instead a reasonable person. And it's difficult for me sort of to come to terms with because she so obviously was somebody who was blazing paths for women, for other women to follow in so many fields. And yet she didn't see herself as a woman.
Yet she was a sponsor of the Equal Rights Amendment in the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And she's been a mentor to many, many women. What would you like to say about the impact that that has had?
Well, I think it's been enormous in a lot of different fields. Certainly, when I was a young law professor, she was very welcoming and encouraging to me. And I know that she herself was the first woman law professor at Northwestern, and she helped to recruit the second, and that second one was African-American. She has been very helpful to women wanting to go into politics. All of them in Illinois feel indebted to her. They come to see her to ask her advice. She's formed a number or cooperated with a number of groups that assist women in getting into leadership positions, both via networking and outright training. There's a group that she and some others work with that helps a certain number of women each year who are interested in a job, in a career in politics, and gives them training. Training in how to run a campaign, how to raise money, how to do the kind of public speaking and campaigning that you have to in order to gain public office.
Yeah. Now, this has been quite, in one sense, a wonderful political life, yet it's been, from time to time, perhaps quite often, a pretty rough political life. The campaign she waged for governor, for example, was quite rough. What kept her going? What keeps her going?
Well, that's mysterious in a way, almost. Even back at the Constitutional Convention, a friend of hers kept coming and saying, Dawn, you just never give up. It's amazing. And that's been her persistence, her dogged persistence in pursuit of goals in which she believes is really almost unique. She doesn't get defeated. She has things that she has been fighting for that she's still fighting for in her early 80s. Campaign reform, in Illinois, there's a lot of reform needed in the judicial system as well as in the political system to prevent corruption. She's got things that she wanted, and she won't give up. She figures that eventually they're going to come about, and she has patience. I think she's also realistic about her goals, that she knows that she's in it, that all of us who are interested in civil rights or civil liberties have to be in it kind of for the long run. And somehow for her, temperamentally, she's just suited to long-term battles.
Hmm. Tax reform and education funding, also a couple of issues very important to her and continue to be important to her.
To the state of Illinois.
we will talk about that maybe here in a moment or two. But tell us a little bit about what in talking with her about that campaign for governor, that was rough. And she, in the general election, her opponent was Jim Edgar, who was thought well of in the state of Illinois. From her point of view, what did she have to say about that campaign and the toll it took on her, or what it was like to be in the midst of that? And did she Did she enjoy that campaign?
Well, enjoy. I mean, a campaign involves a lot of things that she doesn't like doing, and specifically fundraising. And she really hates to ask people for money, and she has to do that. She had to do it in the gubernatorial campaign, certainly. And she was massively outrun by Edgar in terms of the amount of resources. That he had a campaign chest that had been building up over years, and she had just been effortlessly reelected to the Senate and as comptroller and hadn't been raising funds. And so they were very unequally matched in that respect. So it went really very well through the primary, and the primary was a huge victory. But when it came to the general election, Edgar, of course, could fund ads in favor of his own program, and he could fund negative ads against her. And this was the year of negative campaigning against women candidates. The same ad person worked for Edgar as worked for George W. Bush in Texas in his attack ads against Ann Richards, the former governor of Texas. And the theme of those ads were women can't be strong enough against crime. Who do you want there at 2 a.m. if something really critical happens? Will a woman be able to protect you? That's not pleasant. But Dawn can take that sort of thing. She felt kind of personally bad about some couple of things that happened. For example, there was a revelation about a mistake that her husband, Walter, had made in relation to taxes on this condominium studio that he owned. And they ran with that as an issue against a woman whose integrity is just above question and really devastated her husband, because he felt so bad about having inadvertently created this problem for her. And that kind of thing, she finds that sort of thing very upsetting. She has a sense of personal integrity in campaigning that doesn't allow her to do that to other people. So that kind of negative campaigning and fundraising, those are things that she really didn't enjoy. Now, you know, when it became obvious that she was going to lose, she's very realistic. And she accepted that. And I think in part it's because of her realization that all of these things are long-term, and that if it's not today, then keep on, it'll be in the future. And that's what she said to her disappointed campaign workers on the night when she conceded in what turned out to be a landslide election against her. Indeed, it was a landslide in the entire United States. This was the year of the Contract on America, or whatever it was called. And, you know, the Congress, the Senate, governorships, the Democrats were beating a fast retreat. And Illinois was, you know, could be seen as a subcase of that as well.
Yeah. Contract with America, that was Newt Gingrich's
right
proposal, and it was the early 1990s.
Yes. 1994 election.
1994. This is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this morning is Cynthia Grant Bowman. She is the author of a biography of Dawn Clark Netsch, A Political Life. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. You can join us by email or with a phone call. The phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. You mentioned Walter, her husband. What a love story, and what a long, wonderful marriage. When did they meet, and What drew them together?
Well, they met when they were both fairly old, and I think particularly for that period of time, she was 37 and he was 43. And I think that she had become convinced that marriage was really not in the plans if she was going to accomplish the things that she wanted to do. And she met this extraordinary other human being who was a famous architect already, who had fairly grandiose plans for himself as well. And he didn't mean for them to get in the way of his career, for marriage to get in the way of his career. And he was willing to grant that same freedom to her. And the two of them really supported one another, grew to appreciate one another's area of expertise, and had a 44-year partnership that is really quite amazing.
Let's take a call now from a listener in Penfield on line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm very glad you've written a book about such an outstanding woman while she's still with us to enjoy it. And
yes.
I've met her several times and really have admired her career. I have two things I wanted to mention. One is, I assume in your book you treat, and maybe you can talk a little about her work in the Constitutional Convention in 1969 and 70, and how her group of reformers, even though we don't think of that Constitution as very reformist today, there are a lot of reform parts in it, and she and her group of reformers had a lot to do with it. The second question, or the second comment, is you were just talking about the governor's election. And another big issue is one that's still with us. She came out for an increase in the income tax as a way of making taxing more fair in this state. Jim Edgar's campaign moved very much against that. And during his last year in office, when he wasn't running for re-election, then he changed his mind. But that was the center of his campaign against Don Barton Edge. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'll
for
listen.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, those are both very interesting comments. Dawn played a really very influential role at the Constitutional Convention in 1970. As a member of a small group of reform-minded people who were seen as a kind of third force in a way, because you had Republicans from downstate and from collar counties around Chicago, and then you had the Democratic Party that was dominated by the first Mayor Daley and the patronage machine. And this small group of reformers were challenging them on numbers of issues. And the Constitution that emerged was really a very good Constitution for, first of all, it was, the old one was from, you know, like the 19th century, so it was really outdated. But the new Constitution had important guarantees in its Bill of Rights, and it took on this question of taxation. Prior to then, Illinois didn't have an income tax. The Constitution was interpreted in a fairly strict way about what and how taxes could be imposed. And it's since this Constitution that, and she was the co-chair of the Revenue Committee, through which these important kinds of issues about taxation were discussed and decided. And that's been a long-term interest of hers, government finance. And as you've mentioned, it was her theme. I mean, she had the Netsch plan. And for her, she ran for governor, basically not because she needed something to crown her political career at that time in her life. She was 66. But because, as she stated to somebody who tried to talk her out of running, you know, I think I could change things. I think I could make things better. And Illinois is really not in good shape. Now, that's still the situation today. And her plan was a kind of tax swap, that the income tax would be raised while the property taxes were lowered, and there'd be various sorts of deductions and exemptions to make it easier on people who were not very well off. And that would amount both to a fairer system and also, finally, adequately fund the schools and have the state taking a more major role in that. Of course, you know, it's not usually regarded as wise to run for office saying you want to raise taxes. And her opponents, both in the primary and then, of course, Edgar, just jumped on that and said, you know, she's a tax-raising, spending liberal. And then the irony, as you did point out, is that Governor Edgar ultimately came around to suggesting the same thing. And it's often felt that one of the reasons he couldn't get it through the legislature is because he had criticized the whole plan so much during the election.
Yeah. And it is interesting, though, to think back on his campaign for reelection, because he campaigned on making a temporary income tax increase permanent. And that was a rough go. He managed to do it, but it was a rough go. But it was pretty clear pretty soon after the first election, when Don Clark Nutch was the Democratic candidate, that the state was in bad shape financially.
So. Yes, definitely. And she was really on the inside because she had been comptroller for 4 years and I think came into that job and was stunned by how bad it was. She said that during the transition period, someone took her aside and sat her down and said, well, the first thing you need to know is we don't have any money. And she started to learn about all these sleight of hand kind of tricks that the state uses in order to pay its most basic bills. And that in so doing, they're holding off on paying vendors. And in a sense, they're by borrowing money from people like small independent pharmacists who aren't getting reimbursed, and instead of being willing to go out and borrow. So it was a real eye-opener for her. She also was somebody who was speaking up very early about the whole problem of unfunded pension liability. And that's something that's, you know, still a huge problem. And that is that there's not enough money in the pension system to pay for the pensions. And the state has dipped into those funds to pay for other expenses. So she, you know, she's kind of a, is it Cassandra, the classical person who called out things that were true but that nobody wanted to hear.
Mm.
She did that.
Yeah. You know, that makes me think of her experience in the Stevenson campaigns of the 50s.
Yes.
That has to have been quite a formative experience for her. I think it was summer of 52. She's graduated from Northwestern Law School, and she has a job offer, but she postpones going to work for the law firm, in order to work on the Stevenson presidential campaign, Adlai E. Stevenson. Why was she so committed to Stevenson?
Well, you know, when I started working on this project, I had about the same question. And I got to ask a lot of people that question, because I interviewed members of this little clutch of people who had been so inspired by Stevenson, including Abner Mikva and Willard Wirtz. And there was something about his absolute integrity and intelligence. And of course, he was an incredible public speaker that drew them to him. Really, really talented people who might not have been willing to go into politics. He was able to draw them to Springfield to work for him in his administration. And after he lost, I mean, obviously he was governor of Illinois, mm-hmm. and so that's where they worked for him. But after he lost the presidential campaigns, they kept those kinds of ideals about government that was not corrupt, government that was fair, government that that had the kinds of values that many things that we've by today recognized, like, you know, fair housing, equal employment, etc., that they wanted to keep the faith. And so they formed an organization back in Chicago, the Committee on Illinois Government, a group of them, to try to keep whoever was in Springfield honest in relation to those kinds of issues. And they just, Stevenson had this amazing effect on all of them. When I'd ask any of those people about him, you'd see this kind of look of dreamy admiration in their eyes, that they wanted to continue to do what his vision was for America.
And when he came to office as governor of the state of Illinois, things were in a sorry state then.
Mm-hmm.
Seems that this is a story that repeats and repeats. What was he like as governor? What were things like when he came into office?
Well, I mean, it's going to sound a little contemporary. I mean, there was a lot of corruption in various bureaucracies, and many of the kinds of institutions that we assume or take for granted today didn't yet exist. And many people were just in it for themselves. And he recruited, you know, people like Ben Heineman and Willard Wirtz and this generation that, you know, some of them became the best and the brightest under Kennedy, to come there and to start head agencies and to help him. And it was a real turnaround. And obviously, it's not one that lasted in the long run, but the ideal of trying to reach those goals stayed with the people who worked for him.
Hmm. In the 1960s, she served as one of Governor Otto Kerner's aides. Was that her introduction really to the nitty-gritty of state government?
Well, certainly to the nitty-gritty of the executive, because she was his assistant and was right there in the midst of planning policy, orchestrating strategies for how to get it through the legislature, making appointments to boards. And she really had a chance to see everything from the inside, both to see the constraints under which governments operate and to see the possibilities.
There are, I think, a couple of chapters in the book that deal with her struggles against machine politics. How has she negotiated being a member of the Democratic Party while occasionally or regularly being outside the machine?
Well, she's done that in a way that's almost unique. That is, she never saw the goal to destroy the Chicago Democratic Party. The goal was always to open it up, to have more participatory democracy, in her phrase, to not have it controlled by a small group of people that had controlled it for a very long period of time and were sort of self-perpetuating. And but she believed very much in the Democratic Party and wanted to, you know, contribute in remaking it. She also is somebody who doesn't take a stand and then just refuse to compromise. This is something she said about Governor Dan Walker, that he would decide this is right, and he'd circle the wagons, or whatever the metaphor was. And that she thought, you can't go anywhere in politics like that. You have to be willing to talk to people to understand their point of view, and when necessary, make compromises. And that's been a skill, her skill at diplomacy and compromise has stood her in very good stead. She, of course, initially, she and the current Mayor Daley were at loggerheads. She was in the legislature at the same time he was in the Illinois Senate, and his committee would hold up her bills, and she'd get very, very angry. And this antagonism became kind of famous in the press. And she worked with him. Illinois Mental Health Reform Act was handed, she'd been working on it for years, it was handed over to him because he needed something to make his name after his father died. And she went to him and said, you know, my only concern is that you won't take this seriously and put in enough time on it. It's going to take a lot of time. And when he came back and said, I'm willing to do that, she worked with him. And, you know, let him take the glory, let him take the chairmanship, as long as it was increasing the path, you know, the distance toward the goals that she'd been seeking. And I think they grew to have a real respect for one another at that time. And even though they would end up on different sides within the legislature in various battles, they grew actually not only to respect but to like one another. Yeah. You know, she chaired his campaign for attorney general.
As I recall that...
I mean, for state's attorney. Sorry.
As I recall, in the 1970s, I was fairly young at the time, but I was interested in journalism at the time. That was really where the current mayor of the city of Chicago really began to make his reputation. That was a big thing for him, and it was in the, I want to say, in the late 1970s, that mental health reform.
Mm-hmm.
This is Focus. Yes. Our guest this morning is Cynthia Grant Bowman. We're talking about Dawn Clark Netsch, a woman who has spent her life in politics, serving in the Illinois legislature as comptroller and making a run for governor. She was also a ConCon delegate. That was the Constitutional Convention of 69-70. And the Democrat, she has made a mark on Chicago and Illinois politics, Dawn Clark Netsch. She's now in her 80s. She remains an advocate for political reform. Currently, she is a professor of law emerita at Northwestern University in Evanston. Our guest is Cynthia Grant Bowman, the author of Dawn Clark Netsch, A Political Life. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. Look forward to your joining the discussion. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free 800-222-9455. You may also join us by email. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu. What are her thoughts, Cynthia Bowman, Dawn Clark Netsch's thoughts on the political landscape in Illinois today?
Well, she's sort of discouraged. I mean, so many, the whole corruption trial of Governor Blagojevich, and she and Abner Mikva served on his transition team to chair the ethics committee and to lay down ethics rules for the regulation of the executive branch. And, you know, apparently he wasn't particularly interested in following them himself. That and then the seeming collapse of the financial wherewithal of the state, which is not unique. I live in New York State now, and we're in somewhat similar situation, as is California. But this inability to confront the need to raise the income tax, to appropriately fund state and local governments, to take on all of the tasks that government should do for the protection of the people, that's very discouraging to her. Now, you know, she spent, 60 years fighting for things that still haven't been accomplished.
In 2008, I want to talk just a little bit about how she remains active. And in 2008, she got on the bandwagon to campaign against a proposal to have another constitutional convention.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, the Constitution says that every 20 years that issue needs to be placed on the ballot. And the Constitution that was passed in 1970 was not perfect. But the kinds of changes that people suggest when they're advocating a new constitutional convention, in her opinion, would make it worse rather than better. For example, now Governor Quinn wanted a constitutional convention in order to add various popular initiatives, referenda, et cetera, to the Illinois Constitution the way they have those in California. Now, many people think that the state of California is not blessed by having all of those devices in the state constitution. It's what allowed the Proposition 8 to overturn the decision of the California Supreme Court by just a majority vote of the people at an election concerning same-sex marriage. Now, that's not something that Dawn thinks would be a good thing for Illinois to have. And if that question were opened up, those would be the sorts of proposals that might be there. And so she also, it's very expensive to have a constitutional convention. The state has barely any funds. So these were all reasons that she was opposed. And she, if there's something that needs to be fought about that she feels strongly about, she still gets out there and does.
How did she feel about the cutback amendment of 1980, which was proposed by Pat Quinn when he was a young populist out there? He had been part of the Walker administration, and then he and his brother they became active in trying to the political scene in Illinois. Let me just leave it at that. And this amendment, which was got on the ballot through a remarkable effort, not only reduced the size of the Illinois House, but it changed the way representatives were elected to the House. What was Dawn Clark Netsch's stand on that at the time?
Well, I think she favored it at the time. It certainly brought a large number of allies to her cause into the House, into the Illinois legislature. She has had a kind of love-hate relationship with the Illinois, as you recall, used to have multi-member districts.
Mm-hmm.
And you could bullet vote for somebody, like take three votes and give them to one person.
Mm-hmm.
And she's gone back and forth on that issue. That was, as you know, abolished in Illinois. But she thought then that it wasn't the way to run a state. Well, it wasn't the way to run an election. And yet it has, and she acknowledged, it brought in minorities and got representation of points of view that wouldn't otherwise be there. So I think she always sort of sees the pros and the cons of any change.
And the cumulative voting system had its ups and downs, or its pros and cons. And but one of the things that as you alluded to, as you've said, is that it was a way to bring minority representation into the chamber. In other words, it wasn't so lopsided, one party or the other.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's very important to her, a multitude of voices. I interviewed a lot of people who have worked with her in various non-governmental organizations, public interest groups, and to which she devotes an immense amount of time. And they talk about her as being kind of the perfect chair, in a way, that she listens to everyone with respect. She pays attention, that is, you know, will change her view or modify it in light of what they say. And, you know, she's a real true believer in the sort of John Stuart Mill belief that you need to get all points of views out there in order to reach the wisest result. And she's also got person skills that are wonderful. She's capable of telling somebody with whom she disagrees that, you know, you have a point there, but, you know, have you thought about this? And doing it so diplomatically that the person doesn't feel attacked.
Yeah. That, you know, going back to her experience at law school, that served her very well in law school. As I mentioned in the introduction at the beginning of the program, when she entered law at Northwestern, she was one of three women in the class of 52. She was the only one to graduate, and she graduated at the top of her class. Now, so she was essentially the only woman in the law school.
Well, there were some in the other coming up
classes, yeah,
her.
Okay.
But not many.
Yeah, but not many.
Yeah,
And I think many of us are familiar with the story of the career of Sandra Day O'Connor. It was really tough. What was her experience? What were her relations like with the faculty and her fellow students?
Well, excuse me. It's interesting. They were very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
Dawn was kind of accepted as one of the boys. She had as her best friends the men who were at the top of her class and who went on to play very influential roles in Chicago legal circles and political life. And they were friends, and they all respected her. I don't know whether they saw her as sort of an exception. I think it formed her own notion about sex discrimination in that she didn't feel that she ever saw any that was directed against her. And it took her quite a while to see that her experience was unusual. Mm-hmm. That, you know, as I said, she's just not intimidated by anything or anyone. And, you know, that's asking a lot of people who are just coming in as the first women in a field or minorities who are there in token numbers in the beginning. But she had a great time at law school. And her law school class, she was not only an acknowledged leader, but that class went on meeting for almost 50 years after they graduated.
That's right. The bonds that they formed in law school were so strong.
Right.
Tell us the story of when Dawn Clark had mononucleosis.
Oh, yes. She had mononucleosis her third year in law school. And all of these men were, you know, sort of coming and visiting her in the hospital room and joking, of course, about the kissing disease, as it was then described. And when she got out, after a week in the hospital, she was very weak and could barely get herself to the law school. And they all came, picked her up and drove her and were tremendously supportive of her. They gave her referrals for jobs that had come to them and that the law firm would never have thought of hiring a woman, but the person at the top of the class says, well, I'm not available, but how about Dawn? And sings her praises. And so she had an extremely good relationship with the other people in her class. Now, the people who taught her, I guess I spoke to Willard Wirtz before he died. And, you know, he described her as, you know, she would speak right up and he didn't describe her as typical of women law students at that time, though, that she always said what she thought and would take other people on if she disagreed. And it's not that common when a group is just making its way in. They're usually kind of silenced instead.
Hmm. She's now a professor of law emerita, and she has spent many years teaching at Northwestern Law School. What is she like as a teacher?
Well, I've never been her student, so
right.
I can't really tell you that. I can tell you what she's like as a colleague.
Okay.
She's wonderful. And I can tell as a colleague observing her that she takes an immense amount of time over her teaching. She writes elaborate comments on every exam and takes so long and excruciating amount of time to grade her exams because of that. She's always working on being prepared with a very last minute law on any subject that she teaches. She has, in fact, stayed in on the various editions of the state and local government textbook, of which she's a co-author. And, most people kind of drop out and get replaced at a certain point. And she actually, in the last edition, was still responsible for a chapter. And extremely good person on a committee and a colleague to have. Very personable. Mm-hmm. Some of her ex-students became extremely devoted to her and went on and worked for her in her political campaigns and indeed, remain her close friends to this day. Mm.
I would imagine that she has very much enjoyed the classroom. It's just the sense that I get from what you've talked about her experience at Northwestern Law School as a professor from the book.
She really enjoys interacting with people, you know? Mm. And one of the things about being a professor is that each year you come into contact with and get to know people who at this point are quite a bit younger than you are and have very new and interesting insights that might not have occurred to you. And she finds that, very vivifying. Mm. And she just likes being with people, too. You know, she's very warm. And one of her campaign managers was worried about when she had an all-state campaign, instead of just being able to stay, in the 43rd Ward or wherever the comparable Senate district is on the lakefront in Chicago, how was she going to cope with, a farm community in downstate Illinois? And this person told me, so we flew her in, and I felt like these people were going to think she was like an alien getting off a spaceship. And they loved her. In fact, she was a little reluctant to go, not knowing what to expect. And she'd get into these conversations with people, and it would be hard to pull her away. And indeed, she said to me, I really enjoyed campaigning downstate. I got to know people who, whose lives were different. Their interests were like their economic interests and everything were different from anything I had ever known. And, you just have this sense of a genuineness that people recognize if they come into contact with her and talk to her for just a few sentences.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. Well, the time is gone. Cynthia Grant Bowman, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
It was fun.
Cynthia
Thanks
Grant,
for having me.
You're very welcome. Cynthia Grant Bowman is the author of Dawn Clark Netsch, A Political Life. The book is published by Northwestern University Press.